Kanga Audio.
A quick thanks before we start the show. Filmmaking Confidential, the book, is now an Amazon.com and Audible.com bestseller. I just want to say thank you to all of you who ordered it and for your support. If you haven't yet picked it up and you want to learn my filmmaking secrets, Filmmaking Confidential is for you. It's available wherever books are sold in most countries around the world. Order by visiting Audible or Amazon. To find out more, check out filmmakingconfidential.com and stevebalderson.com. Thank you. I'm Steve Balderson, and you're listening to the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. In this podcast, we meet with filmmakers, writers, actors, artists, and other notables. Today's guest is musician Christian Hoffman. Christian Hoffman came into public consciousness as the best friend of Lance Loud in the PBS series An American Family. During the mid-1970s, Hoffman emerged as a songwriter and keyboardist for New York City-based band The Mumps. He has collaborated or stood next to everyone in the music industry.
I was raised by wildly liberal parents who were kind of paid to be liberals. Like, my father worked for a think tank called the Fund for the Republic, otherwise known as the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And what he was doing for a living was trying to write a constitution that the whole world could embrace, where the entire world would be loving and democratic and we share all the food and all that kind of stuff. Of course, that never happened. But so my mother was a poet. She was also a radio host on a Pacifica Foundation radio show that was stories children love. And she read fairy tales every Saturday morning and we'd all sit and listen to them. But she was also a big peace activist, and we were dragged to every single anti-war protest when we were little kids. And in Santa Barbara, it wasn't a liberal town. So we were kind of perceived as kind of eccentric clowns, sort of, but it was welcoming to that. It was the thing that they said when you first moved to Santa Barbara was, newlyweds and nearly deads, because it was kind of a locale for you to go to. Either if you're going to get married, it was kind of a resort, or you would be very, very old. And in a way, that was kind of true when we first moved there. I think there were only 60,000 people living there when we got there. And we moved into a big house in Montecito, and my parents were well-to-do. My father got paid well for his job, and we lived in big houses. But it was funny, because big houses then were perceived as white elephants. If you were wealthy, you would go and build a new house that was modern somewhere in the mountains. But we lived in a big, old, rundown house on Oriole Road in Santa Barbara, and it was fun. It was like living in the Addams Family house. There were seven kids, and we always had a foreign exchange student living with to help take care of us, and it was just wild. And my parents were there was a person across the street named Stevie Fisk, and he said, "I know about you and your family, and I'm going to write 'fuck you' in silver spray paint on your driveway, and you're going to lose a lot of friends." And I said, "Well, go ahead. I don't care." And this is like in fourth grade. And so he made a timid little fuck you on a stair. And next time I saw him, I said, "Your fuck you is so small. I feel badly for you." Even though superficially it was an extremely conservative town, the way we moved about in it was not conservative. I said I was dragged to the peace marches. So we would go to the peace march outside the art museum at, I think it's Annapamoon State Street. And it's a very nice little art museum. And because rich people donated their art to it, it has some really nice works in there. But there'd be like four people at the peace march. And, you know, people driving by would throw their garbage out the window at us or honk at us or yell, you know, curse words. Or some of them would go, "Cool, right on," you know. So, but it wasn't like we were being stalked or ostracized. And my mother was a actress at the time, and there's a really nice theater there called the Libero Theater, and she was in plays there regularly. So she had a whole repertory of really cool, great, eccentric actor friends that would come over every New Year's Eve. And she was in like The Ugly American and like liberal classics. So. Yeah, so it was, and then when we met Pat Loud, I wasn't out to myself yet. I knew that I was different, and that wasn't an issue with my liberal parents. But it wasn't brought up to me that they might think of me as being gay. But Lance already knew he was gay when I first met him in high school, and he was 16, I guess. And I was very comfortable with that. I was attracted to him not because he was gay, but because he was the most sardonic, acidically satirical person in the art class. And he just sat with Mr. Baker, who was turned out to be gay, but I didn't figure that out at the time, the art teacher. And he loved to just have Lance sit there, and we would badmouth all the other students in the class right in front of them. And so I felt like, well, there's a cabal I feel really comfortable in. So I sort of went over to that corner and sat with them. And since I was a quote unquote good artist, I could get away with sitting there with him and still get good grades. But he happily, even though Lance was like his best friend in the class, he would just give him bad grades, you know, because so much time gossiping that he didn't do his homework.
Well, and how was, if he was out, I mean, people knew and he didn't care, right?
I would say being out, he wasn't declared as being out. To me, I felt comfortable with him. And then it turned out we found comfortable with each other when we revealed our sexuality to each other. And I didn't even know mine until I met him. And I thought, like, oh, that's why I'm feeling this way. But it was super easy. And it was easy in high school because we were sitting with this, unbeknownst to me, queen. And why did we feel so comfortable with the guy who watched old 30s movies at 3 o'clock in the morning? You know, it's a cliche of that time. And so it was easy, but there were people that would yell at Lance, faggot, when he walked by. But, you know, it was the end of the hippie era, and the hippie era was like a kind and generous, even though lots of hippies didn't really like fags. The whole theme or ethos of if it feels good, do it, and make love, not war, and all those kind of hippie things. And we actually thought hippies were stupid, but they made it not so horrific to be of a somewhat different sexuality for that one brief moment. And so even in Mick Jagger looked like a big fag on stage. And then David Bowie came along a little bit later when I was already buying his records in high school, but I was buying, I'm the laughing gnome and you can't catch me, those sort of things. He hadn't come into his, I think Hunky Dory was released around then. But there were these representations of kind of pansexual, if you will, people. It's funny, like Elton John, out of all those people at the time, was the one who wasn't really out. And he was the biggest fag of them all. But so it was comfortable. And then because we both had very liberal parents who were trying to encourage us to be artistic and be adventurous. One thing about Pat is she was highly educated and she could quote all of this poetry from the 1890s at the dinner table. And she had read all of the philosophical greats. And she would say those in ways we could understand because she liked to share her knowledge with us. And they all encouraged us to go out and be in the world. And so when my mother finally sort of uncomfortably asked me if I were gay, I said, yeah. And I didn't want to make an issue out of it, but she just said, oh, that's just fine with me. And I love you just as much anyway. And the only thing I'm worried about is you might be hurt. So because some people don't like people just because they're gay. So if you ever get hurt, just come to me. And Pat did that's the same thing to both of us. So there wasn't any, we didn't have to make some instance or political statement out of coming out. We just were already that way. And it also, as Lance shared famously on the Dick Cavett show, he said, gay, what the fuck is gay? One finger and 10. I'm not gay. I'm trying to be in a band. I love to dress crazy. I love to go to New York and meet other crazy people. I don't think of myself as gay. And it was funny when the Mumps sort of started getting, you know, we never were that huge, but we were pretty big in New York. We could sell out little clubs all over the United States. And some of the reviews started coming out and saying, gay songwriter Christian Hoffman. And I would get in fights with the journalists at that time. And I'd say, I am a songwriter. I'm not a gay songwriter. I compare myself to great people who I will never measure up to, like Leonard Cohen. And I aspire to melodies like the Beatles, like a regular songwriter. And whether I fail, I'm not failing on gay terms or winning on gay terms. I'm a songwriter. So in that sense, we had a grasp of sort of being liberated gay people, because we didn't think of, I didn't walk down the street thinking, oh, I'm gay. I walked down the street thinking like, oh, that conceptual art is stupid.
You know? Yes, no, I totally know what you mean. I mean, I say that there are gay filmmakers.
Yeah.
And they primarily work with stories and themes and whatever about gay culture, gay life, being gay, all these things. And then there is a filmmaker who happens to be gay.
Yeah.
You know, and he or she can tell other stories also.
And that art needs to be made. And I'm glad it's being made. And some of it's just as bad as straight art and some of it's better. And, you know, we can all succeed or fail at our own chosen profession or discipline. But that isn't how we perceived ourselves. In fact, we had this really bad joke. I don't think you can get away with it. We thought, like, are you aligning us with gay culture of fag? And that was just our dismissive joke about that kind of culture. And also there was a fight amongst art gay people in the punk scene, like we were, and regular gay people who wanted to be like the people at Studio 54 or just had to dress as, you know, they had specific prototypes where you would try to look like Burt Reynolds, or you would try to look like a leather jacketed Harley Davidson rider, or you would try to look like a disco queen. And they were like these perceived sort of uniforms you had to wear to be made acceptable in general middle-class gay society. And so we all hated that. And that's what we call gay culture fag. And we thought, like, I want to be able to dress in this outfit or just dress in regular clothes or get dressed up as a duck or a cat. Or, you know, we didn't like the limitations of that culture. But of course, we did like to fuck those people once in a while.
Well, of course.
That could happen.
Did you start making music with Lance before you went to New York?
We attempted to make music. And, you know, the funny thing is, like, my family, everybody was artsy and musicians, and the ones that are still alive still are. My brothers and sisters are all extremely gifted painters and can play instruments, and they're songwriters and they're writers and everything. But my family was completely unsupportive of each other. And we were taught by my elder brother, Paul, who later committed suicide, is there a connection, that we should be in real competition with each other and try to destroy each other. So he taught my younger brothers and sisters, every time I tried to play the piano, they would come into the room and say, "That's awful. Can you just please stop?" And so to actually be able to rebel against that and decide alone in this family of seven kids, I was just going to do it anyway. I kind of give myself a little bit of credit for that, but I couldn't understand the negativity then. And then so when I met Lance, it was a culture of being friendly and being excited about being in the world. And then Pat Loud had a room that was there. All of her kids wanted to be in bands. At least the boys did, and the girls did sort of tangentially. They ended up being backup singers and dressing up in crazy glam outfits and everything. But so Grant was a great guitar player. Kevin was a great bass player. They were always in there, and they had a garage that was dedicated to just having musical instruments in there. And Pat said that people could come over, but you had to let them be in the band. And so we had this, I was playing around with them and we would hang out, and I was struggling trying to write little songs at the time. And Lance was very eager to sing them because we were best friends and we did everything together. And so the first song I wrote for them, which is actually the first song I ever finished, was called "I'm God." And it was just a 12-bar blues thing. But I was dazed. Let's see if I can remember it. I was dazed. I was confused. But then the answer, I did see the earth would have one ruler and the ruler would be me. I'm God. And it was just. And so that was the first song we ever rehearsed with those kids to have an original song in the band, because we would just do like weird. They were already into the Velvet Underground, so we do a Velvet Underground cover, but they loved the Rolling Stones, so we do some Rolling Stones covers. They weren't so into melodic pop at the time like I was. Like, I think I brought the first Sparks album into their house, and Lance immediately liked it, but the other ones thought, like, well, this is weird and it's kind of unpleasant. So I was kind of like the little pop nerd. But so we were allowed to do that. And then we practice and practice. And then there was this opportunity somehow through Pat that the Los Angeles cast of Hair was going to have a cast party at the Polo Grounds just south of Santa Barbara. And she got us hired as the band. And so that was the first time we actually played live together as a band at this ridiculous thing. And Lance and I had been to Altamont And we had taken a cassette recorder with us. And so we recorded Brown Sugar on the cassette recorder, and Rolling Stones hadn't released it yet. So we played that for the cast of Hair and said that we had written it. And they didn't like any of the rest of our songs, and they loved that song. And so I was thinking, like, oh, songwriting does make a difference. You actually have to try to write something good. And then we stole their PA.
Amazing. How did the transition come to go to New York?
Me and Lance always wanted to go to New York anyway. We wanted to go somewhere, and it was very inexpensive to go to New York at the time. I mean, I think a flight across the country cost $50, which in contemporary dollars is maybe like $250 or something. So it was very inexpensive, and you could go there. So he wanted to meet Andy Warhol, and you might have heard this story already, but even before American Family, he had figured out a way to get in touch with Andy Warhol via phone. I think maybe he was in the phone book in New York because he used to tape all of people's conversations with him. There's that book that's just Andy Warhol taping all the conversations with Pat Ast and Joe D'Alessandro and all those people. And so he decided that he liked talking to Lance, so he was calling him fairly regularly. And, you know, now he would probably be arrested for doing that because Lance was like 14 or something. But then Pat would just say, like, oh, it's Andy for you, Lance. And they would just talk on the phone for 45 minutes or something. So Lance really wanted to get there and be part of that thing. And he was completely in love with the Velvet Underground. We actually went and saw the Velvet Underground at the Whiskey once, and we somehow ended up at their hotel room, but nothing happened. But so we went there to do that and just to be in New York because it was exciting. And we went there with our friend Alonzo King, who has since become a sort of famous choreographer. And he was in Santa Barbara High School with us in dance class, where we all ended up when we wanted to get out of regular sports. And so he was Black. And, you know, that didn't really register with us at the time. We thought he just was one of the cool kids, and he was really fun. And later on, I realized, like, oh, it's Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara's supposed to be so racist and everything. But we had lots of Black friends. So that part, in retrospect, we either were blinkered to it or it didn't feel that way when you were in high school. So we three went to New York and moved into a little apartment on 15th Street and 7th Avenue. We didn't know where to look to live. And I think it was like $150 a month. And it was a fifth floor walk up, and the bathroom was out in the hall, and all those cliches. The bathtub was in the kitchen, and the toilet was in the hall and was shared. And we lived there for a while, and we had a fantastic time when we met Norman Fisher at that time, who was ended up being David Bowie's drug dealer later, but which is always nice to know. But he took really good care of us, and then the rumblings of making American Family and all of that stuff were happening. And so I'm confused as to exactly when the filming started, but we lived there for a while, and then we didn't pay any rent, and we didn't get jobs, and we got kicked out. So we went home, and then we lived in Santa Barbara for a while, and Lance even lived at my house on Schoolhouse Road with me for a while. And we were practicing in the garage with our bigger version of the band. We had two wonderful backup singers, Leslie Nicholson and Nancy Darby, who were from our high school, and they were our backing singers. And we were trying to do a kind of Bowie New York Dolls thing, because when we were in New York, we went to see the New York Dolls so often. They played five nights a week at Mercer Arts, that if you went there enough, you just got in free. And so that's where we would spend almost every night of the week. And so we thought, like, well, if they can do it, and not to demean them, because they're my favorite rock band in the world, basically. There's the Cramps, and them are kind of fighting for that. But we thought, like, they write fantastic songs, so I think we can do that too. And so we went back and worked in the garage. And then the thing that happened was Dick Cavett was going to have the Louds on for a second time, I think. I'm not quite sure, but Pat said, I'm not going on unless you showcase my kids. And so they had us, that band that was the one with me and Lance and David Collard and Kevin was in it. And JD Doherty, who went on to be drummer with Patti Smith, was in it. And he's somebody we went to high school with. And then Grant got to sing Blackbird or something separate from us. And of course, when we did our song, which was Muscle Boys, which was later a big hit for the Mumps. And the guitar part was written by the fantastic David Collard, who has since died. The audience was completely silent, and we got really no response at all. And we were all just thinking, like, oh my God. And then of course everyone loved Grant, because he's really good looking. He's a really good guitar player. He has a beautiful voice, and he sang a song they all knew. And then it was somehow it was broadcast. Either there was a delayed broadcast, or I don't know how they did it in those days, because when I watched it on TV, it was later. We were friends with Steve Paul, who ran the club in, he ran a famous nightclub in Manhattan, and he was very wealthy, and he had a big mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut. And I was really good friends with Duncan Hanna already. He's one of the first people I met when I moved to New York. So we went and watched that at his mansion in Greenwich. And so I was with my friends watching my band on national TV. And then at the end of it, they looked at me and they said, "Oh, that was so bad. That was just awful." And so then I went into the bathroom and I cried for about 45 minutes. That was my first experience of my music being exposed to a larger audience.
Was just, oh my God.
But the thing about getting to New York at Dick Cavett is Lance and I said, "We're not going home. We got a free ticket to New York. We're going to figure out how to live here." And, you know, Lance, did sleep around. So he found an apartment that we could sublet from somebody he'd had sex with that was on the Upper West Side. It was a beautiful kind of, it was a vintage loft apartment, and it had a parlor grand piano right in the middle of the living room so we could play there. J.D. Doherty decided to stay with us, but everybody else left. They said, "I'm not staying in this place with this loser band." So we just stayed there, and then it took us years to get a band together, but we finally did. And Duncan Hanna found Rob Dupre for us, our guitar player. And then we had a really great bass player named Aaron Kiley for a while. And then he decided to move back to Vermont. And so Richard Kinster from Orchestra Luna got us Kevin Kiley. He just said, "I have the bass player for you." And then when J.D. Doherty finally quit, because I introduced him to Patti Smith and she asked him to join her band, I learned not to do that anymore. The guy from Milk and Cookies, Ian North, he said, "Well, I have a drummer for you if I don't keep him myself." And he just gave me Paul Ruttner just out of the blue, and he was perfect. And it was so easy once we got going, and it was just really fun. And we played everywhere and were enthusiastically received until we didn't ever get a record contract.
Christian Hoffman. Another wonderful guest is cult icon Mink Stoll.
John Waters will tell you a story that I threw a saxophone at him. We didn't speak after we finished filming Pink Flamingos. I moved out.
You can hear my full interview with Mink at filmmakingconfidential.com in our archives or by subscribing for free to this podcast. We'll be right back with Christian Hoffman. Stay with us. I'm Steve Balderson, and this is the Filmmaking Confidential podcast. I'm back with Christian Hoffman.
What I think about it is that we weren't that commercial. When, like, there was one thing about Clem Burke, who kind of like was thinking about maybe joining the Mumps at one point, and we were all really good friends with him and Blondie, and we loved Christine, and we loved Debbie Harry, and I knew Debbie Harry since she was in the Stilettos, which Elda Stiletto was one of the lead singers, and she sang a song that you probably haven't heard. "I left my Wednesday panties in Passaic." That's in New Jersey. How could you
Amazing.
Get a song like that? So, but Clem was kind of toying with the ideas of joining us, and then he said, "I think I better stay in the band with the chick." And he wasn't saying that in any demeaning way. It's just Debbie Harry was beautiful, had a beautiful voice. It wasn't like a difficult sell like Lance was. Whether or not he was gay, he was kind of bumbling, and he kind of sang out of tune sometimes. And we were a lot of cacophony, and sometimes it coalesced into a wonderful show. And sometimes it was kind of, you know, somewhat unprofessional. And lots of people found us really fun and loved the songs and would sing them along with us when we played them. But I could see we didn't have the commercial potential of, say, a Debbie Harry or a Patti Smith, who had a very direct kind of message that you could really grasp on first listen. And also, you know, we were in the middle of punk and we were trying to be a pop band. So the bands that all said, "I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, fuck you," they were very clearly regimented and designed to be a commercial enterprise. There was no question about what message they were delivering. So that was an easy sell. Whereas all of our songs were like, about a variety of different instances and kind of had a sarcastic outlook. But then the one thing that happened is when we did get to be a really big band and got able to sell out the Whiskey three nights in a row or whatever the fuck it was, we were put up for A&M Records, and the Dickies were put up for A&M Records. And A&M Records was a conservative record label, but they wanted to have one punk rock band in case it got big. And so there was between us and the Dickies, and we were really good friends with the Dickies, and the Dickies actually sang on That Fatal Charm and stuff like that. So it wasn't, there wasn't any ill will between us, but they actually, my manager was in the room when we got refused at the last minute, and they just said, well, we're not sure we want to take the band with the fag in it. So that's the one instance I know where there was actually gay prejudice. But in a weird way, to me, even at the time, I thought like, well, we were a commercial risk and the Dickies didn't have that risk. And the Dickies were fantastic songwriters and really charismatic. And I, one of my favorite bands, and we played with them loads and loads of times, and they were really good friends of ours. So, and it was also weird, like other bands like The Quick were signed, who we were really good friends with, and they were straight, but they also had a very fey pop sound, and they got to make an album and then it failed. And so there might've been some sort of warning, like you don't want to sign the band that has this allegiance to this kind of sexually indeterminate pop.
Right. What do you do as an artist when trying to make a living and you're too out of the box for the ordinary traditional folks, yet you're too traditional for the out of the box folks?
Yeah. I think that New York had a lot to do with that, because at that time in New York, it was a community thing. It was a tribe. And we had loads of friends in all sorts of disciplines in the art world. We were really close friends with Patty Astor, who opened the Fun Gallery. I was close friends with all of the people who did, you know, about that New Wave Vaudeville show started, and we became friends with the producers of that. I actually already knew them because they lived next door to us. Bradley Field was a drummer for Teenage Jesus, and I was really good friends with Lydia Lunch at the time, and I would tune her guitar before she went on stage at Max's Kansas City. And if you have me tune your guitar, you really can't play. And but we, it was a whole tribe of people. So it always seemed like if you didn't succeed on that one level right now, you might in the future. But meanwhile, you're just going to be with all your friends and make as much crazy stuff as you possibly can. And you were, you know, I worked at bookstores to survive, and working at Cinemabilia, that was my day job for a while. And I was working at Cinemabilia with Terry York, who managed television. I was working with Richard Hell and my guitar player, Rob Dupre. Cinemabilia was a collector's, cinema fanatics collector's bookstore. So it, all of the stock in there was just wonderful. I stole my Haley Mills Whistle Down the Wind lobby card from there while I was working there. So that wasn't really like day labor to me. It was like being in a situation where I was actually being paid to be in one of the wonderful bookstores of the world. And then I went and worked for Barnes & Noble later. But I worked at bookstores until I could actually make a living being a musician. And when we got our really expensive rent for our whole floor loft that Bradley Field and I lived in, and we also had a rehearsal space downstairs, that was $700. And we thought, oh, that's outrageous. But I was in five different bands. I was already working with Klaus Nomi, and I was in the Contortions. We toured all over America together. I was in Bleecker Street Incident with Ann Magnus, and we went back and forth to LA several times. I was actually making money being a musician, just being in that scene. And when I finally moved to LA, it was kind of a shock that you couldn't just get a tour walking out your door, you know, being in the community of the East Village. You would actually just get asked to go play somewhere, or the band called The Shades would come and stay with you, or, you know, the Dickies left their equipment at our house, and the Rebillos left their equipment at our house, and we would just borrow their van and drive around and get into all sorts of trouble. It was like being in a fancy college. And so it didn't really seem to me that there wasn't the possibility of something fantastic still turning up, even if the Mumps didn't get the record contract. When we broke up the Mumps, it was really, really hard because we had been together for almost 7 years. And we finally were getting to do a demo for Sire. And we had made a plan with each other that if we didn't get this record contract, we were going to break up because we thought like this is sort of our last chance. And to me, it wasn't so hard because I was already doing all this other stuff and making those underground films, what, Rome 78 or whatever it was, the Long Island 4. And I was surrounded by all these crazy people. But for Lance, it crushed him because he just assumed whatever I did, he would just go on and be with me in the next project. And I wanted to try something new. So that was a really kind of painful divorce. That tribe was, it was a gift. And even in the middle of it, we all realized like this likely, if it's happening anyplace else in the world, they're very lucky because it probably isn't happening in that many places where everyone lives in a 10 block radius from each other. And every single one of those people is in a band or making a film or they're a painter or something crazy.
What a dream.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have loved to have experienced that, you know, like just even to go back in time right now and just feel it.
You couldn't walk out the door without running into someone who was in a band and was telling, and they're just opening a new club on Avenue C or something, or, you know, or something like that. It was just weird. So it gave me a very positive outlook on everything. And you know, for a while I was working for New York Rocker and not being paid. You know, there was an underground newspaper at the time, sort of underground. It had aspirations towards being a real paper like Interview, if you can call that a real paper. But like I would write reviews for them and draw illustrations for them and all this kind of crazy stuff. I did the first article in New York ever on The Blessed and just ridiculous stuff like that. And so there was always like a whole bunch of disciplines coalescing and you were friends with them.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Tell me more about working with Klaus Nomi.
I've been asked this story a lot of times. Is that okay to just tell it again?
Yeah, it's fine.
It doesn't matter that it's a hoary old war story. Well, the thing about Klaus Nomi was that he was in the New Wave Vaudeville show. So I didn't know him before then. And Susan Hannaford and Tom Scully, who, as I told you, were my next door neighbors on Grand Street, they decided to produce this vaudeville show, and they had an idea that you could stand anything for 3 minutes. And so they just all invite all their friends. They'd get this real theater, and we'd run it for a couple nights. And so I had been, part of the time I had been living with David McDermott. Do you know who he is?
I don't.
McDermott McGough. You should look them up. They're fantastic painters, photographers. But I had been living with David McDermott before he ended up with them. And he was a complete eccentric. He wanted to live in the past. So when I lived in his apartment on 82nd Street in Central Park West, he took out all the electric. He wanted to live before electric. And so we spent the time together reading books to each other by candlelight at night. There was no television. But I did still go on tour with the Mumps. And I remember one time we got into an argument because he was really into 1890s attire. So when I was on away on tour, he thought he'd give me a big present. So he had all the collars removed from all my shirts so I could wear vintage detachable collars. And like I thought that was kind of campy, a Brooks Brothers button down shirt. And I thought that's vintage too, but he didn't like it. So he thought he was giving me this fantastic gift, and we got in a huge fight about it, about how dare you take off the collars of my shirts. He had a huge, crazy, kind of invasive, it's that kind of operatic voice, it's like this, but he could sing really high and loud. And so he was the MC of the New Wave Vaudeville show, and he was really funny. He got all dressed up in the full coat of tails, and he sang, a pretty girl is just like a pretty boy, which was outrageous at the time, because that's an old song from the 78, and it was a classic, but it didn't go just like a pretty boy, that he switched around the lyrics. And so he was wonderful and charismatic, and he introduced everybody. And I wrote the songs. I wrote a song for him to sing that was a parody of 30s Egyptian movies. And it was about the King of the Nile. And Susan Hannaford painted about an 8-foot tall version of a camel pack of cigarettes as the backdrop. And David had slaves crossing the stage and he was whipping them and everything. And so it really was a crazy variety show. And then to close it, and Ann Magnuson came from West Virginia because she had graduated in theater and she somehow knew Susan Hannaford through being a pen pal or something. So she came there to have her first real theatrical experience, and she was the kind of producer director with Susan Hannaford. So I met her there too. And so Klaus closed the show, and everything else it was a fantastic show, and lots of my friends from LA came to see it too, because back then you would just go visit people and stay with them for 6 months, and it was fun. So he did that on the stage, and it was complete silence. He sang the Samson and Delilah, the opera theme, that is a horrific, tragic aria, but it's uncannily beautiful. And he was dressed in outer space clothing, and the whole back of the stage where he was on was dark, and he only had little flashing lights on his face. And he sang out in this most ethereal, gorgeous voice you've ever heard in your life. And none of us had paid any attention to opera. I mean, my closest thing I ever got to opera was hearing a Mall and the Night Visitors as a child. It was like, oh yeah, that's what opera's like. The kings are three and one of them is black. It was just silence afterwards. And then finally there was uproarious applause, and he was the big hit of the evening. And in fact, after the first show, David McDermott had to get out there and say he's actually singing, because people didn't believe anyone could sing that way, and they thought he was lip syncing to some old record. And so they had to prove that he was really singing live. Wow. But the spirit of the time is such that Anya Phillips was my friend. She was managing the Contortions, and I used to hang out with James Chanson on Anya Phillips all the time. And she said, you know, that guy who closes the show, you should just start a band for him. And I said, hey, that's an idea. So I just called him the next day and I said, do you want me to start a band for you? And he said, okay. And that's as hard as it was. That was just what that time was like. You know, and it might have worked out that he didn't like me or he didn't like the songs I wrote. But it immediately worked out really well. And Paige Wood, who was in one of the other acts, he was in a band called Come On, but he did an act called Businessmen in Space. And all they did was they came out, it was like they were dressed as businessmen, the three people from his band. They carried briefcases and they played this kind of track that was sort of rocking like this. And then they opened up their briefcases and they had electric guitars made out of foam rubber, and they shook them around for a while. That was their act. But it turned out he was a fantastic drummer, so he ended up being the first drummer for Klaus's band. And I got a variety of people I knew to play on the record, like Robert Mache came and played guitar on it, and Paul Ruttner did a drum fill and stuff like that. But it worked out very copacetically. The only thing that happened during that was, it was the first thing I did that ever looked like it was going to have real success. And we were having a fun time playing Danceteria and Hurrah and selling it out. And we got on the NBC News, nightly news for some, but it was, you know, it was condescending. It was like, there's this weird guy who's causing a sensation. And then they'd show Klaus and it looked like, you know, some freaky fag from outer space. But of course his voice was completely transcendent. So it was like this, it was like one more in a long line of very exciting things to be allowed to be part of. And then I did write his defining songs. But as soon as it smelled like success, we had a meeting with the record company, which, and I'm not kidding, was in a building called 666 Fifth Avenue. And it was a huge 666 at the top of the skyscraper. And they were trying to get me to sign a publishing agreement with them. And I said, no, I'm going to have my own publishing. I'd read all the stories about people having their publishing stolen. You know, in the early 70s, you'd heard about all those people on Motown and even original folk singers, everybody, they got all their publishing taken away from them. So I already knew that horror story. And so I said, I'm going to start my own publishing company. And so they released the records without telling me, and they took the publishing. And I got kicked out of the band for a very, some really weird reason. And it really hurt my feelings, but I didn't get mad at Klaus, because I knew what he knew. He thought, this is my shot in life. I'm actually gonna be able to get out of New York. I'm accepted, because he wanted to be a real opera singer when he was younger, and he was in Germany working in opera theater. And he didn't tell me the story till much later, but he actually wasn't accepted as an opera singer, and countertenor was not considered fine opera at the time, or that's the story he told me. I don't know anything about opera. But so he was finally gonna be accepted and become the great personality. And it was like, I didn't want to rob him of that opportunity. And I was happy for him that he was going to go somewhere. But I was on tour in Amsterdam with Lydia Lunch, and I was her drummer. She took me to New York, to Europe for a tour, and we actually toured with The Cure and with The Birthday Party, which is ridiculous. And she didn't write any songs. So she said, just go out there and play something slow. And I did. And then she would just lie on the floor and wail. And that's how I got to tour Europe then. But so I was walking down the street in Amsterdam, and there was the Klaus Nomi record in the store, and nobody told me. And then it had two of my songs on it, which were defining the Nomi song, Total Eclipse, both of which were released as 45s. And it had some publisher's name on it I'd never heard of. They didn't even tell me the record was coming out. And so then what happened with Klaus later was that, so I thought like, okay. And then I thought I would be able to get some money from that somehow, but I didn't. They never paid me a cent for any of that stuff. But then they recorded the second album, and what they told me, and this is all the information I have, so, you know, I wasn't in a close relationship with any of them at the time, but they told me that the RCA France, which is his mainstream label, had rejected the record, and they actually asked them to get songs from me, and they might release the record. So I had written Total Eclipse and Simple Man already for him, and I thought they were going to be the best songs for him and that I'd ever written. And so I brought those into the studio, and I was actually at the recording sessions that time, and it was really, really fun, and they let me do whatever I want, and I arranged the songs and brought my friends in to play them, and we were recording them at Electric Ladyland, which was really exciting. And so it all seemed to be going really well. And I said, you know, I'm going to have my own publishing. And I got a lawyer to draw up something with my publishing on it. And they did it again. They released the record again under their own publishing. They didn't pay me anything ever for those songs for years and years and years. And finally, a guy, Randall Wixon, who's a wonderful guy who publishes like Tom Petty and Neil Young and everything. He had seen the Mumps play at some place in Topanga Canyon years ago. And he somehow got in touch with me and said, do you have a publisher? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'd like to be your publisher. And so he runs a big company. And so I was assigned a representative at that thing. But he took care of my publishing for all the other little projects, because I had three solo albums out and stuff. And he took care of all of that stuff. And then he got me back the publishing for Klaus Nomi. He had to sue them or something. So after, you know, 10 or 12 years of not ever being paid anything, and those, you know, the records weren't huge hits. One of the singles was like top 20 in Germany or something, but they were respectable, and they were released in England and France and Germany and all over Europe. They were released in Australia. So there would have been some minor income from them, and he couldn't get me the back income, but I finally owned those songs outright. And then when Mark Almond did his cover with that German band Rosenstolz, that was really exciting. Like, actually my song came out with my own publishing for the first time in my life. I mean, the first exciting thing about it was they decided, because I said to them, I said, isn't it really weird if we make an anthem about Klaus where he discusses him being a simple man, because it means like he's available to be supportive and to be loved and like a regular human being, but he dresses like that crazy alien from outer space. And so they loved that idea. And then they used the title for the cover of the album. And so then it was even more shocking that they somehow fired me again and didn't pay me any money. I was just thinking like, God, how can they do this? But I didn't have the money to hire a lawyer, and they worked at 666. So.
Right. You can't fight the 666, but at least you got it back. I mean, at least.
Yes, I did. And also Joey Arias remained my friend through all that stuff. And we went to the Klaus estate meetings at 666 Fifth Avenue. And he was very stalwart and stood up to those people. And I stayed friends with him for years and years. And I actually toured Europe with him about 7 years ago or something and had a fantastic time. And so he was very helpful. But this is the tragic part of the Klaus story. Because the rest of that is, it's all misadventures, but who gets to have a voice like Klaus record your songs? Who gets to go in there and work in the studio with that voice? Who gets to arrange the songs for Klaus Nomi? I got to do that. But so he came back from Europe, and he would call me on the phone, and he was very, very sick. And he said, they made me tour and tour and tour and tour. And I was so sick. And I kept saying, can I go home and go to bed? And he said that he came back to his little apartment in the East Village, and they wouldn't even buy him a hospital bed, even though he'd been touring all over Europe for them for about a year straight or something. And we didn't really know what AIDS was at the time. It was right at the beginning, and we kind of got it over the course of his illness. But at the beginning, it was called gay cancer. And then it was called the 3H Club because only homosexuals, heroin addicts, and Haitians ever got it. And so straight people in the world didn't have to worry about getting gay cancer, even though in Africa they didn't tell us, but it was a heterosexual disease, you know. But so it was, and it the rumor was that it was airborne. And so when a friend of yours got sick, you were scared to visit them. So the whole time when Klaus got diagnosed with HIV, AKA gay cancer, we were too afraid to visit him. And also I was like, why is he calling me? Didn't he make any other really close friends over the course of being on tour with this big successful band and playing for a whole orchestra in Europe and doing all that stuff? And he called me every day. And I'm sure he called other people. He didn't know what to do with himself. He probably called someone else right after me. But I would talk to him, and I would tell him I loved him, and I would tell him I wanted him to be better, but I would tell him I'm scared to come visit because we don't know how you get it. And then I would just lie on the floor and cry for an hour after every phone call. I didn't know how to support him, and I was scared of it, and I'd been hurt by him. And it was just a weird, crazy, gay, pandemic horror story.
And it's awful.
My boyfriend Bradley finally succumbed to AIDS, but he was also a heroin addict too. So I guess they were right. Homos and heroin addicts were somewhat at risk, and all the indiscriminate sex and everything. But we went, me and Vicky Galvez went to visit him in the hospital before he died. And we had to wear those hazmat suits. We had to be like in a complete like rubber suit with, you know, a visor over our, to go and visit him in the hospital. And we took him like some McDonald's because he hated the hospital food. And we handed that to him with our rubber gloves. It was a very weird medical moment. And that's when they knew more about it.
Did you play any of the music that is on Mink Stole's album?
I didn't play on that record.
But you played with her and when she would...
Yeah, I was in a band with her for a couple years here, and we always played at Casita del Campo, and we played at some other little clubs around town, and it was really, really fun, and she was just a joy to work with, and it was so easy, and when she decided she wanted to sing a couple of my songs, it was like, you know, it was like manna from heaven. It's like, now I get to work with another fantastic, crazy, eccentric, and, you know, Lance and I first saw, what's the first John Waters movie, the one that's in black and white, with the vine coming down the back alley. Anyway, we went to see that. They wouldn't show it at a regular theater, but they showed it at the drive-in in Santa Barbara. So we were very excited. And I think I took my mom to see that. So, in any case, we just thought, like, now we're meeting this person from this whole other coterie of crazy people that are all involved in a wild outsider community. And she was just so nice, and the other people in the band were nice, and we were really good friends with that guy, Brian Grillo, and that there was a whole other little community we ended up hanging out with him. But then she wanted to move back to Baltimore because her mother was ill, I think was the story. I could be wrong about that, but I know
I think you're right.
Moved back for some family emergency. And I had been to Baltimore many times on tour with various bands. So I love Baltimore. And I understood that going to live in this beautiful town where Edgar Allan Poe's grave is, in these old houses and then being closer to your family was, you know, an understandable thing to do. And then the record came out, and I was just thrilled that she covered a Mump song that we never actually recorded ourselves. And so the Waiting for the World to Catch Up is an old Mump song.
Oh, cool.
And God, if Any is a song that I released on my solo album as a duet with Abby Travis. And
I love Abby.
Yeah. So she picked that song to cover, and it just was joyful. And I got to send the chords. You know, I can't read music. So she had a real piano playing on it, and I sent him my chords, and I don't think he understood how I wrote them down, because even I can't understand them. There were one or two chords that had like a diminished ninth in them, but I don't really know what a diminished ninth is, so I don't know what they were.
You've also collaborated with Rufus Wainwright.
Yes. I have a good story about that, too.
Oh, good. Tell me.
Well, the thing about Rufus Wainwright is that Lance and I didn't know anything about him, but we knew that he was Kate McGarrigle's son. And Lance and I, Lance used to write for a magazine called Rock Scene in New York, and it was kind of when we were trying to get the Mumps together when we finally did. But we used to get all the records for free in the mail because Lance might review them. And so in the middle of us getting into the punk scene, the Kate and Anna McGarrigle first album came, and we thought it like it was the greatest album we'd ever heard. And I still think it's one of the best albums I've ever heard. We were just in love with them and obsessed with them. And so when Rufus Wainwright came to play at that place on, what's it on Fairfax? Largo, was it? Where he has a residency. And we had heard bad reviews about him. We heard that he has a very piercing nasal voice and his songs are very meandering, but Kate McGarrigle might be there. So we didn't tell him that, but we just went there hoping that we'd see Kate McGarrigle. And then we ended up just loving him and thinking that he was really amazing, but he kind of fell in love with Lance a little bit. He might deny this now, but he was sort of obsessed with Lance. And so Lance had an in. And so when he, at that time, was recording his first album, which we got a preview copy of because we were psychophants, and we thought it was really great, but he didn't have a touring band together yet. And so I helped him get together a touring band after Lance insisted, you need to let Christian in your band or I won't ever forgive you. And so I was kind of forced into Rufus's band, but we were already good friends and having a good time together. He wasn't obsessed with me in any way, and he was a fantastically genius piano player, and he was schooled and could read music and all that stuff. But I played second piano, so I played the string parts and other little noodles. Or when he was playing acoustic guitar, I would copy the piano part off of the records, and I could do that because I play by ear and I'm pretty good at it. I've only been in 20 bands already. So I was in his first touring band, and I think I got DJ Bonebike and Jonathan Lay to be in it for a while. I think DJ finally got let go because he had another thing to go to play. And I got confused because some of the people that I was with in Rufus's band were in my band with Dave Davies as well. But in any case, so I toured with Rufus for about a year. We finally got to tour Canada. We went once across with Sean Lennon. We were touring with him. So we went all the way across America with Sean Lennon, and he was the headliner. And then when we got to Canada, Rufus was the headliner because he was from Canada. So, and then when we got to the airport, it was so magical. We were met by Kate McGarrigle, and she got us through customs really fast because she was the star there. And we went to her townhouse, and we were welcomed there, and she cooked dinner for us, and we hung out with her on her rooftop. And it was just, it was like a total epiphanous moment where you think like, how does this stuff happen in your life? I'm sitting here with the greatest songwriter in the world. Well, you know, Joni Mitchell might be a little bit better, but she wasn't available. Met her too, though. But So I loved Rufus's material. By that time, I really thought he was a genius, and I was allowed to sing backup vocals with him. And everyone in the audience always said that our voices really resonated together beautifully. And then one time this boy came backstage, and I thought, well, Rufus is over there. And he said, no, I want to meet you. And Rufus was so excited. He had the big room on the tour bus, you know, with a private bed. And he said, you can have my room tonight. And so, with this boy in Canada because he thought I was the cute one and stuff like that. So I thought we were all really close. And so then we were at one day we were going to breakfast. So I want to say I had a fantastic time the entire time I was with Rufus. We had so many wonderful experiences. I was being paid fairly well at the time. It was $1,000 a week, which is a lot of money for me. And had so much fun. And Sean Lennon was just wonderful, really supportive. And he was one of the people that told me how great I sounded with Rufus and everything. So I got taken to breakfast by Rufus and his tour manager, and they sat me down at the table. And I thought, well, this is nice. And so they said, well, we have something to tell you. We're going to fire you. And then I said, what? Because we were kind of in the middle of this tour that was just fabulous. And they both told me, yeah, you're old and unhip. And that's a direct quote.
Really?
I got fired from touring with Rufus because I was old and unhip.
Oh, my God.
cautionary tale. The weird thing about it is, like many things in life, he's an artist, he's on his arc, and he's doing all this crazy stuff. And I wish I had been able to be with him to tour for the second album, which I didn't get to do because I love the second album too. I love so many of his songs, and I think he's a genius. And, you know, he has to go his way. And I think my story is more remarkable than if they had just let me go. That's all I'd have to say. But that they actually, I wouldn't have that story to tell if they hadn't said that horrible thing to me and sent me home.
No, that's crazy.
Yeah, but that's why they said they fired me. But our relationship was repaired, and we got to be good friends again. And I saw him regularly and always went to his shows. And then he was very close friends with Lance right to the end. And, you know, we both played at Lance's funeral, and which wasn't fun. And, you know, yesterday was 20 years to the day that Lance was dead.
Wow.
So yesterday was a hard day to crawl through, just like... But so, you know, I'm in touch with Rufus now still a little bit, not as much as before pandemic. I think we would probably be, you know, when he came to LA, we'd be having lunch at a restaurant or something when he's passing through. But you just don't do that now. So
right. Exactly.
So it's hard to tell where relationships, pre-pandemic relationships, stand right now.
Yeah, for sure. Wait, you also what did you do with Jane Wiedlin?
Jane Wiedlin, I love Jane Wiedlin. I was really good friends with the Go-Go's. They were our friends when we were in the Mumps, and everybody came to all the different shows. And the Go-Go's hadn't quite started when the Mumps had started, but they were starting around the same time. One thing that was funny about the Mumps is when we went to New York the first time, I mean to LA the first time, we were the first New York band to visit LA. So everyone in LA showed up. Every single person who was going to be in the Germs or the Weirdos or the Go-Go's or the X or all of those people showed up. They all took us to their houses to dinner. They were so excited to see us. And then the next time we went, which is only like a year or two later, LA had its own scene. And X was a band, and Go-Go's were a band, and all of this stuff. And they were kind of like, we don't need that New York music anymore. There was a little bit of this snubbery. But most of our good friends stayed friends with us, and Jane Wiedlin was one of those. And I used to see her often. She'd invite me over to her house when she lived in Silver Lake, and you know, we were just hanging out. And then she was going to try and do this thing where she thought, I know a fun way to make money. We'll just get together an oldies band and we'll do kind of, you know, 30s, 40s jazz standards, and I'll sing them, and we'll get to play on tour boats. And that way we can just play at dinner time for some stupid tourists, but we can do it in like the Mediterranean at weird tourist stops and go see all the museums and the castles and get paid and just have fun the entire time. So we put together this band with really talented people. I think it's William Bongiovanni was the bass player and Joe Berardi was the drummer. And someone's going to kill me because I can't remember who was playing guitar. Was it Pierre Smith? I don't know. So we rehearsed for that for a long time, and it was really good. And Jane, you know, she's wildly charismatic. She's really funny, and she can sing too. So it really seemed like an easy sell. And we went to this thing in Las Vegas where you actually auction to get managers to do this kind of commercial stuff. And people came there to see you if you wanted to be like an opening act at a big bar in Las Vegas or something. And it was kind of like a big group of people all at different little booths auditioning, and no one picked us up. There was a big line of people watching us and cheering and everything, but it didn't turn into a remunerative proposition. And then she moved on to the next thing. Right. But it was going to be a really wild adventure if it worked out. So
God, could you imagine? That would be a dream.
It was such a smart thing on her part. And I bet if she did something similar to that, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years later, it would have happened. But it was really fun while it lasted. And when the Go-Go's played, and Abby finally got into the Go-Go's for a while. And so we would go see them whenever they played in town. And it's just fun. Belinda, who we all knew as Bindi back in the day, when I was in the Swinging Madisons, she used to hold on to my shoes from the audience and scream, "Christian is a 10! Christian is a 10! I used to sing Having My Baby as the closing number for the Swinging Madisons, and it was a satire. And actually this friend of ours used to lie on the ground and pretend to have a baby. She'd have a blood thing that splattered out of her dress, and then she'd pull out a rubber doll during it, and it was a big, crazy, rocking version of it. And Belinda loved that. So, and that woman's name was Pester. She has since told me her real name, but now I forget because I knew her for as Pester for years and years. But she was part of the Pleasant Gaiman, Brian Tristan set of people. And so Belinda wrote on the Go-Go's first single, "To Christian, in hopes that I too may one day have your baby." So
love it.
She never did.
Well,
I think I'll sue her for breach of promise.
I think you should.
I am the Zelig of rock. I basically stood next to everybody. So, and it's a rare privilege. I wish I had a hit song other than the Klaus Nomi ones. But then I got to, you know, I had some guy named Greg Dwinnell was starting a record company, and he was putting together tribute albums, and he put together a tribute album for the Bee Gees. And it was funny, I had met him and he wanted to put out an album by me, and I don't know why, but he was really nice. And Jonathan Leigh, who's in this band called The Jigsaw Scene, wanted to put out a tribute album to the Bee Gees, and he couldn't get it together. And so I said, let's buy that from him. And so Greg Dwinnell bought the project from Jonathan Leigh, but The Jigsaw Scene still did a fantastic song on it, and I did my Bee Gees cover. And then Greg just said, well, we'll just put out your records. And so he put out 4 solo records for me. No, 3, because the last one was put out by another guy. Fop was put out. But he just supported me through all those years. And all of my records have the most high, crazy, critical regard, and no one bought any of them. It's like, for Fop, I had so many reviews that said, every song is a work of genius. And I was thinking like, well, maybe somebody will buy this. But it didn't work out that way.
Musician Christian Hoffman. Tune in next time for more Filmmaking Confidential. It is totally free to subscribe. And when you subscribe, you'll get upcoming new episodes automatically. And you'll have free access to all our past shows. The Filmmaking Confidential podcast is a production of Dakanga Audio and produced by myself and Ella Spencer. Our original theme music is composed by Kevin Robles. For more of the Filmmaking Confidential podcast, head over to filmmakingconfidential.com. If you have a question about filmmaking you'd like me to answer on the podcast, send me an email using the contact form on the website. To learn more of my filmmaking secrets, be sure to pick up a copy of the book, Filmmaking Confidential, available on Audible, paperback, and ebook, wherever books are sold. I'm Steve Balderson. Thanks for listening and spreading the word. Until next time, keep making, keep doing, keep going.